There we go.
Good evening. You're listening to WPKN, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 89.5 FM, streaming live at WPKN.org. Welcome to our show, In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with Gus Cantavero.
Good evening.
We'll be with you for the next hour, and Dave Schwartz will be back next week. We'll be taking your calls in a few minutes, and we'll announce the call-in shortly, the call-in number shortly. But first, Gus and I are going to take a look at some of the important recent developments in the news. One important story that came out recently has to do with the former President George Bush Jr.'s new book, Decision Points, in which he's admitted that he personally approved a request by the CIA agents to use waterboarding, which you may know is a form of torture that simulates drowning. Bush recalls in his memoir that when the CIA asked him whether he could proceed with the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged plotter of the 9/11 attacks, President Bush replied, "Damn right." The Washington Post also reported that former Vice President Dick Cheney also acknowledged supporting torture. Quote, "I was a big supporter of waterboarding," end quote, he said in a television interview. In addition to the Bush administration's record on torture, we see that the Obama administration has, I think, unfortunately, continued the same practices. And the Assistant General Counsel of the CIA, Daniel Pines, recently claimed that the practice of abducting terror suspects, kidnapping them overseas and sending them to third countries for interrogation is legal, he says, legal under U.S. law, even where the third country may subject the kidnapped individual to torture. Well, I don't know how you guys feel out there. Maybe you can call in tonight and let us know what your thoughts on this. But as far as this person is concerned, I think that the Bush and the Obama administrations in engaging this kind of illegal activity are drawing our honor through the mud. And please let us know what you think. Obama administration also in April has approved the extraordinary step of authorizing the targeted killing of American citizens. In this case, they were targeting the radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. And it turns out, as the New York Times wrote in April 6th, that both the CIA and the military maintain lists of terrorists linked to al-Qaeda and its affiliates, or I should say alleged to have links to al-Qaeda and its affiliates, who are approved for capture or killing. So things have come to a pretty pass in the United States, I think, when we've stooped to this sort of behavior. It makes you wonder what our founding fathers would think, that this has become a routine American foreign policy. Do you have any thoughts on that subject as far as the torture, the kidnapping, the assassination?
Well, we know that the torture doesn't work, for one. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded, what was it, 100 and...
Something like 170, 180, phenomenal.
157 times, I think, was the number, something like that.
And then he confessed.
And he confessed to blowing up buildings that were built 4 years after he was arrested.
He confessed to just about every assassination but Abraham Lincoln's, I think.
it doesn't work, all right? The results are unreliable. And to say, damn right, I'd do it again, you know, all it does is reveal what, you know, his cowboy mentality and reputation that he's gotten since leaving office. It just confirms all of those things.
And it makes you know, once you've broken the rules of the game, why can't other countries engage in similar
activity? That was always the reason, or the mentality of America. It was, you know, we're the good guys. Going all the way back to, you know, the First World War, it was that we don't do those things. That's what they do, you know.
That's right.
We don't break the rules. We play by the rules even if they break them, and we still beat them, you know, because we're number one.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's where that mentality comes from. But then somewhere along the line, the standards just devolved into this, we'll do anything it takes to win.
It's kind of American
exceptionalism.
American exceptionalism. It may be bad for you to do it, but it's okay for us to do it because we're doing it.
Yeah, we spun the tables. It was we don't do that stuff, and then it was, well, we do that stuff because we're the good guys.
and now you wonder, of course, can you believe anything the government puts out to justify these criminal acts.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that this Anwar al-Awlaki, who is now
the CIA presented,
he's presented to us in the mass media as the incarnation of al-Qaeda, as the successor of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, right.
But Fox News reported on the 20th of October that he was a luncheon guest
of
the military brass at the Pentagon.
Yep.
Within months of the September 11th, 2001 attack. Now, here's a guy who was interviewed four times by the FBI in the first week after the attacks because of his ties to the three of the hijackers, including Hani Hanjour, the man who supposedly navigated an
the
airplane
pilot.
into the Pentagon. Well, as those people, our listeners who may have researched this independently or listened to the shows that Gus and I have done in 9/11, it's certainly the evidence is now quite compelling that the government has lied to us about 9/11, that Hani Hanjour probably did not pilot that plane.
He was also one of the least qualified of the pilots, or of the hijackers. One of them was an ex-fighter pilot, and Hani Hanjour was the flunky of all of them and performed the most... the most impossible maneuvers.
Impossible maneuver. And, of course, more recent evidence also indicates that that whatever hit the Pentagon was not an airplane. That comes from the Major General
Stumblebine,
the former head of Army Intelligence, who told German TV that it was no question in his mind that whatever hit the Pentagon was not a plane. And you can see that video on YouTube. So what does that make al-Awlaki? It certainly makes him look like he's part of whatever this elaborate false flag operation was. So this guy may be, it looks to me like he's another patsy, that he's been set up.
Probably one step above patsy, though. Probably more like a handler.
Maybe, perhaps.
You know, but I think during, on the 9/11 show, we talked about sheep dipping. And we played the Joan Mellon premium. And she talked about sheep dipping and how Oswald was sheep dipped and given this communist personnel.
That's right.
You know, he was, you know, deported to, or he fled, went to communist Russia, came back, and had this this personality of being a communist sympathizer and was associating
was
with the Cubans.
Synthesized in New Orleans
exactly.
In order to set him up as a potential
so he was dipped into giving this new personality and a backstory.
Right.
And
al-Awlaki
is used to make first contact with potential terrorists and gives them a backstory of having discussed and sympathized with about terrorists and terrorist sympathies. And so he was connected to the shooter at Fort Hood.
That's right.
All of a sudden these names are
Hassan, Major
Hassan. There's so many names we try to keep up with on a day-to-day basis.
Also with the Christmas Day bomber.
The Christmas Day bomber.
Umar Farouk Abdul
Muhammad
Mutalajab.
Mutalab.
Yeah.
Umar Farouk Abdul Mutalab.
There you go.
It's a mouthful.
Exactly.
And the Times Square bomber.
That's right. So he's the nexus for all this, which makes one think that he's part of the
yeah, you would,
CIA
you would,
operation.
You would be led to believe that al-Awlaki is like this mastermind where he, takes all these future terrorists under his wing and, you know, instructs them on how to commit these acts of terror, with this extremist Muslim belief system that I think most rational people know is not mainstream
Islam. Of course.
Islam.
Of course.
But because they have a first contact with him, they have now an email trail of three or four emails of contact with this guy. And then they have a backstory of saying, oh, look, this is the famous terrorist imam. And, we have another terrorist here. And so now anytime anyone contacts him, they're a terrorist. But...
It's very convenient. Very convenient. As I recall,
but most of these guys have had other warning signs. Mutalib, his father, contacted the CIA station chief.
That's right.
And warned them that he was getting mixed up with the wrong guys. And Hassan had months and months of emails going back saying, "What should I do? Should I get involved with this or not?" And
what really happened in that shooting at Fort Hood?
There was also other people.
Other people shooting.
The first day, you always believe the first eyewitness stories, all right? Because they always always get it right. Just like 9/11 and other false flag terror events, it's the first reports that are correct. Just like this inkjet toner cartridge bombs that were sent last week, the first story said that they had no bomb in them whatsoever. And then the next day,
that's
the spin machine starts and Obama gets on television, says that they tested positive for explosive materials, not saying that they're bombs so that they don't have to release the tests. Because it gets into some kind of gray technical area if you say it's got explosive material or you say it's an explosive, it's a bomb itself.
Right.
Because anything can be explosive material. Any kind of plastic can be qualified as an explosive material. And, always believe the first reports. And the thing with Fort Hood was that there were other shooters seen.
Yes.
There were two other shooters seen. And I always thought that story was suspicious, how one guy
could have shot so many people just by jumping up on a
cafeteria table.
It seemed incredible. And I understand also that some of the witnesses there were taking pictures from their phones.
And they were ordered to erase all that material by the Army investigators.
That's right, which is pretty bizarre.
You never erase evidence.
Of course not. But we've seen this pattern in cover-up of 9/11. Where the videotapes of the plane, of whatever hit the Pentagon, they've all disappeared into some secret government place. And there were lots of videos of that.
It was all confiscated.
Another interesting aspect of the Christmas Day bomber is that you mentioned that how he was known to our government that he was dangerous, is the fact that an undersecretary of state named Kennedy testified before Congress that the State Department had flagged him and did not want to allow him to come into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy said, look, we were overruled by a national security agency, and he wouldn't go into further details into public sessions. But of course, why would the national security agency have insisted that this man be allowed into the United States, knowing that he was dangerous, unless it was to help create another provocation for the escalation of the war?
Well, and then later on there was furthering that line of questioning. I think one of the CIA spokespeople said, well, sometimes we like to let these terror suspects fly, even though they shouldn't, because we want to see where they're going to go.
Yeah, which is, it's the whole thing is ludicrous, especially when we consider USA Today reported last week that only 20% of the cargo is screened for bombs. So why would you need to go through any?
How could they screen it all? I mean,
they can't. So if 80% of the stuff is coming through unscreened, if in fact there are all of these Al Qaeda guys out there who are trying to bomb planes, it seemed to me relatively that wouldn't be too hard. In addition, if they wanted to do it in some other way, our border is porous, as well known in Mexico.
Yeah.
You can just walk across if you wanted to create it. So it seems to me there's. If you start with 9/11 as a false flag operation and the evidence that we presented, and you're, excuse me, welcome to go to our website, incontextreport.com, and we have links to much of the evidence about 9/11, but it's really compelling. The evidence is compelling that it was a false flag operation. If you start from that point, then you can see everything else flowing from it, and you have to be very skeptical of any material presented, and especially when you look at the timing. For example, of this supposed recent bombs coming out of Yemen, it seems to be the basis for a buildup. It says, this is from the Wall Street Journal of November the 1st, the foiled bombing plot by suspected al-Qaeda militants in Yemen has added urgency to the Obama administration's review of expanded military options that include putting elite U.S. hunter-killer teams that operate secretly in country, that is in Yemen, under the CIA authority. So it's very convenient that after you have an act like this, that you have then it gives a pretext for an expansion of this war on terror.
Absolutely.
You know.
And that kind of conveniently connects with Obama visiting India, right? Isn't he visiting India right now?
Yeah, he's visiting India
and he's,
now.
And he's kind of like in the heart of that India-Pakistan area of I don't know what's the right word for that. It's on edge.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict, and the head
conflict.
Of Pakistan has said that he believes that a lot of the terrorist acts are in his country's many attributed to Muslim militants are actually perpetrated by the CIA to destabilize his country.
Well, that's kind of a touchy area because I mean the ISI and the CIA have worked together for so many years. How do you know when the ISI in Pakistan is acting on their own?
That's right.
Or they're acting under the instruction of the CIA.
It's a very strange relationship because, of course, in the 1980s, they were our conduit to support the resistance of the Afghans to the Russian occupation. Mm-hmm. So we funneled huge amounts of money through the ISI. Now it turns out from these papers that came out in WikiLeaks that the ISI is working with the resistance against America in Afghanistan.
I would imagine that the Pakistanis, the nationalists there, would prefer to be independent. But on the other hand, they know that the CIA has such far-reaching abilities that they know that they can't go too far outside the realm of norm, so that they will pull off what they're instructed to do, but at the same time, they're going to work against us, you know, in some kind of a strange double agent within their own.
They have a different agenda in there. As I understand it, their principal concern is that the government in Afghanistan not be a pro-Indian government. And evidently, the Karzai government is supported by India. So that's why they really don't, they would be happy to see the Taliban overthrow him. Because they don't want a pro-Indian government, obviously, in Kabul. So we tend to have this view that we see the world strictly in terms of our own values, our own national objectives, and ignore the fact that the region, the players in the region have a completely different agenda. So, we just project and we throw our weight around, but the Pakistanis have their own idea about what they want that region to look like.
And we have no idea when they're acting on their own or when they're acting on our behest. We have no clue as just an observer, citizens.
No, at all. Although, we don't know. No, it was only with the release of these, the WikiLeaks documents that we found out that the ISI was actually participating in attacks on American soldiers, that the ISA was organizing suicide bomb squads to operate inside Afghanistan. And the WikiLeaks, I think, has done a great service to the American people by revealing much of this information.
Although that kind of does sound like the opposite, like it would get the Americans riled up to say that, who are these Pakistanis? We've supported them for so many years. Now they're acting against us. We better go wipe them out. I mean,
why did the American people don't seem to react that way?
Maybe fatigue, or they just don't have enough wherewithal to even think that far.
Maybe you're right. This is the 10th year of the war. Maybe it's just fatigue. The American people really aren't focused on it. I don't. When you talk to people in your neighborhood, do they talk much about the war? I mean,
in totally general terms, no one seems to really understand the details. They just say, what are we over there for? And I'll ask that question. What are we there for? What are the wars getting us? I don't know.
It's just a mess, and then they move on. They move on. Well, listeners, we'd like to hear what you think about the war, the economy, the recent election. Please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's to participate in the In Context program with Ken and Gus. Our phone number here is 203-336-9756. The airwaves belong to the public, and that is true with a capital T here at WPKN, because we are on the air because of your generosity. We are a listener-sponsored, non-commercial station, and we are at 89.5 FM, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org.
You asked about what do the people in my neighborhood say about the war, or the details of the war, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Iraq. They honestly, to tell you the truth, people really have no idea. The people I talk to, if you want to talk about baseball or football, they know everything that there is to know. They know individual player statistics going back 10 years against a particular team, home or away, after a bye week at night. But they won't be able to tell you where is Afghanistan, what is it border, and why is it significant geopolitically.
That's details.
And these are really, really, really important.
And yet, if you look back at, say, the 19th century, even before World War II, it seemed that the American people were engaged in sophisticated arguments about public policy. So how do we get to this point? Is it the media? Is it the education system? Or what do you think it is, Gus, that people just seem to be politically?
Education system is pretty key, I think. I mean, anyone I know in public education is really just like a cookie cutter of the typical consumer.
Yeah.
They're not taught to think critically and question authority. They're taught to take what they're instructed by their teacher and then reproduce it later.
Right.
On demand. And simultaneously thinking that that person is full of crap.
Yeah.
So anyone older than them is an idiot. and but they'll still remember what you said so they can pass the test.
Well, we have very much been afflicted with the white, I call the white coat phenomena, that you've got to believe the guy wearing the white coat. He may be completely wrong. Or as Seinfeld always says about going in to see the doctor makes you take off your pants, because every time, pants beats no pants.
Absolutely.
So if I'm wearing the white coat, or I've got the hat that says I'm a teacher, then you have to believe me, and you should turn your brain off and just absorb what I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think we really need to have a resurgence of critical thinking in this country. We really do.
It's
People
amazing.
Have to be willing to question authority.
That's right. That's the essence. That's the essence of democracy, is you have to be skeptical. You have to question authority.
My grandmother was up to visit this past week, and, you know, we got to talking about healthcare. You know, she saw us taking our vitamins and stuff, right? We have some supplements. My wife's kind of sick right now, so she was taking some stuff to get better. And, you know, she's like, you take all these vitamins. Aren't you worried about side effects? I'm like, well, I mean, it's vitamin D, you know.
Right. This is not dangerous. Yeah.
What's that going to do? If you take too much, you pee it out. You know, it's not like it's going to build up and you're just going to keel over and everyone's going to be like, oh, they didn't know about vitamin
That's
D.
That's my vitamin
how dangerous
D, right?
It is, you know?
The OD on vitamin D.
And, you know, you talk about cancer treatment, you know, and you pump all kinds of toxic stuff into your body with the absolute knowledge you're not going to get better.
Well, the cancer is, it seems to be one of the great scams, the cancer treatments. I was looking at some of the stats, and we spend approximately $100 billion a year on cancer treatment. And yet cancer's increasing all the time. Mm-hmm. So what are these treatments doing? And you look at the most popular one, chemotherapy.
Right.
And I discovered that it came out of the World War II chemical warfare program.
Mm-hmm.
I said, whoa. That's crazy. They're putting known poisons into people's body to try to cure them. And in fact, I think they rarely cure anybody with this.
Well, I mean, look, we know mercury is deadly, all right, but we put it as a preservative into all the vaccines.
Yeah, yeah. So then you come back to why do these things roll along? And unfortunately, the answer is somebody's making money.
Absolutely. People are making money hand over fist. And if people, folks out there, you have to look at, well, We complain all the time about, oh man, you know, things are never going to change. Well, they will if you want them to, because the boycott is the most powerful way to protest something.
That's so true.
And if you want high fructose corn syrup taken out of your drinks, your juices, because it's in everything, and we have the most sugary diet in the entire world.
And look how obese Americans are.
And look how obese we are. The heart disease, the liver disease, kidney problems, thyroid problems, adrenal gland problems, hormone disturbances in youth, you know, because they're drinking high fructose corn syrup, or because the parents are giving them artificial sweeteners as a replacement. Because
aspartame is really
aspartame,
deadly.
Okay? That causes the overproduction of estrogen, so that you're feminizing your boys and your girls are going into puberty by age 7. I mean, we just heard a girl age 10 just gave birth in New York a couple days ago. We have a call.
Hey, good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Ken and Gus?
Yeah.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, this is Ken from Manchester.
Hi, Ken. How are
good
you?
Good to hear
you.
Fine.
This is
Ken, your show.
Great.
Oh, great.
Good to hear you. Ken Doust is the host of a show called New World Notes, upstate Connecticut. And you did recently, you're in the process of doing a show on John Kennedy's a famous speech he made at an American university. Can you talk a little bit about that, Ken?
Yeah, that goes out on Tuesday here in central Connecticut. And I was just going to say, you know, John Kennedy is the last president I can think of who actually not only paid lip service to stopping wars, but actually went and did it.
What a novel idea.
I think Eisenhower did that to Korea, too. And then Kennedy after Eisenhower, and ever since then, they've just been starting them writing and left.
Well, Kennedy was very affected by the tense Cuban Missile Crisis. How did that come into play in changing his sort of worldview towards Russia?
Yeah, well, if you go back to 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion, which he was tricked into authorizing by the CIA, and he realized that he had been played for a sucker by the CIA, and
this would be Alan Dulles.
Very, very publicly fired and humiliated longtime CIA director Alan Dulles, which even Eisenhower didn't have the guts to do. Eisenhower complained to Dulles in private, you know, you've given us a legacy of ashes, but Kennedy kicked his butt out.
And now we have an airport named after him.
The
ultimate honor.
Or was that his brother, John Foster? I forget.
Did that start him to rethink the Cold War? Because when Kennedy ran against Nixon, he ran partly as a Cold Warrior, on the missile gap.
Kennedy was nothing special in the first year or so of his presidency. He was a Cold Warrior, so far as I can discern. He was as shallow and opportunistic as any of them. He got a sense of how these big boys play hardball with the Bay of Pigs invasion. And the goal of the Bay of Pigs invasion was not to liberate Cuba from Castro. The goal of the Bay of Pigs invasion was to start a war with the Soviet Union because they calculated we would win.
I see. They really thought we'd win a war with the Russians, huh?
Absolutely.
That's a scary
thought. All the hype about, the missile gap and the Russians are overwhelming us with their nuclear superiority, that was all false. The United States had overwhelming nuclear superiority to the Russians, and everybody at the top knew it.
Well, one of the skills of the Russians since World War II was their ability to bluff, right? I mean, that's like their greatest asset was to act like they're bigger than they are.
Could be, and that probably proved as big a mistake for them as it did to Saddam Hussein many decades later. But anyway, they knew, we would win this nuclear war with the Soviet Union. We'd lose maybe 30 million people.
Wow.
Russia would lose 200 million people and be completely destroyed, and the United States would emerge as the world's sole superpower.
Mm-hmm. This is Curtis LeMay. He was really hoping that Cuban Missile Crisis would develop into a war with the Russians.
Can you really consider yourself a winner after losing 30 million people and having like a quarter of your country radiated?
Yeah. I'm really, really moving more and more towards the conclusion that at the higher levels of any hierarchy, you will find them overpopulated with psychopaths.
Oh, entirely.
And I doubt that the military is an exception from that rule.
Oh, no, of course.
Yeah. But so, a Soviet missile base was discovered in Cuba in October 1962, mm-hmm. and the war hawks just went wild. You know, we've got to bomb the place, we've got to take it out, we've got to smash the base before they have a chance to arm these missiles with their nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, we discovered they already were armed with nuclear warheads and their Russian nuclear submarines in Havana Harbor. Mm-hmm. But and Kennedy was like the only sane person in the entire national security establishment. And he did everything he could to hold off the war hawks. And then a U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba, and you know it looks like we were going to go nuclear any second now. And he enlisted the help of his nominal enemy, Soviet Premier Khrushchev, who very, very publicly announced that he was dismantling the Soviet missile bases in Cuba and took all the heat, you know, for... We went eyeball to eyeball, and Khrushchev blinked, as the phrase went.
Did they develop some kind of a better understanding after the crisis?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. In fact, they had been secret pen pals for a couple years before that, interestingly enough. But after the crisis, that put the fear of God into Kennedy, because he was one of the few people in this country who realized that we were just on the very, very, very precipice of World War III, a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, and the entire CIA and defense establishment and Joint Chiefs and whole national security state was screaming to let the party begin. He arranged some secret negotiations with Khrushchev, and Khrushchev took the heat.
There was some kind of quid pro quo. They would take the their missiles off Cuba, and we were going to withdraw some from Turkey, I think.
Right. We dismantled our missiles in Turkey very privately.
Whereas, you can't appear to be
Russia
weak.
Russia dismantled their missile base in Cuba very publicly and immediately.
We only moved out because it was too hot.
Yeah.
Well, now can you?
But then after that, I think that put the fear of God into Kennedy.
Can you talk about the speech he made on June 10th in 1963?
June 10th, 1963.
At American
persuaded
University.
Persuaded by Norman Cousins in particular, who was very, very active in the peace movement in the United States. He was editor of the Saturday Review, an influential magazine at the time, that he had to reciprocate. He had to pay Khrushchev back for the big hit that Khrushchev took for saving the world back in October 62. And he gave this magnificent speech at American University. It was a commencement address. Nobody's heard it, you know. Everybody can quote from the first inaugural, ask not what your country can do for you, blah, blah, blah. Probably, you know, very, very few people could quote a line from this magnificent address he gave at American University on June 10th, 1963, in which basically he had all sorts of conciliatory things to say about the people of the Soviet Union. He talked about their great sacrifice during World War II. He talked about how almost alone among major powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had never been to war against each other. That was a little bit of a stretch, but, big, you know, ignoring 1918. And he declared universal military disarmament a goal of the United States of America, and began and announced several immediate steps leading in that direction. First, he announced a unilateral halt to atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. Then he announced that he and Khrushchev had agreed to negotiate a nuclear test ban treaty in Moscow, of all places, starting immediately. And this and that and this and that and the other. And he said, you know, we're going to keep doing this step by step, and they're going to reciprocate step by step until we get to a policy of nuclear disarmament, which is going to be so obviously in the benefit, not just nuclear disarmament, military disarmament, mm-hmm. which is going to be so obviously in the benefit of both countries. All the money we're squandering on the military-industrial complex,
right.
we can spend building, you know, schools, bridges, infrastructure, you know, you can rattle off the list.
Right.
Kennedy actually said this in 1963. Yeah, of course, you know, a few months later, you know, the military-industrial complex was not amused, and a few months later, Kennedy was no longer with us, and a few months after that, Khrushchev had been deposed.
Do you think that Khrushchev was similarly deposed by people who were did not want to see a rapprochement between the Soviet Union and the United States?
Well, I can't claim to be an expert Sovietologist, but yeah, that's my belief. I think he was deposed by the national security state of the Soviet Union for giving away too much to the capitalists. The godless communists had the grace, you know, not to murder the guy. They just forced him into retirement and let him keep his villa on the Black Sea.
Look, I think Kennedy perhaps was more dangerous because of his personal wealth and his charisma.
Kennedy was, for some number of months, the most prominent anti-military crusader in the United States of America. Now, you know, if you were Curtis LeMay or the CEO of Lockheed, you know, this is not good for your career, right?
And, of course, he also had just before he was assassinated, had decided to start a withdrawal of troops from Vietnam.
Yes, and he had begun secret negotiations with Castro to normalize relationships with Cuba.
That's right. He was doing it through a personal friend. I forget the gentleman's name, but
it was the assistant to UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson.
Right. He was sending this fellow down on missions.
Yeah.
To speak to Castro.
The UN ambassador's assistant was talking with Castro in Havana about normalizing relations.
And of course, he's murdered on November 22nd, 1963. And to me, that is such a pivotal moment in modern American history, because it may be when democracy died. Because if the powers that be can successfully stage a coup, the military-industrial complex, whatever you want to call it, and they can get away with it, then it makes a mockery of the democratic process.
Mm-hmm. As we've seen more than once since, you know, people complain, and quite rightly, that the person actually in charge of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, was a longtime Bush and Condoleezza Rice loyalist and hack. Well, who did they put in charge of actually running the Warren Commission and the investigation of the death of John F. Kennedy? Alan W. Dulles.
Incredible.
The man who probably hated Kennedy
and one would
more than anybody in the world. They made him, I forget the exact title, it was,
something. But he basically ran it. And
he was the guy that ran it.
One would guess
ran the 9/11 Commission.
That he must have been involved in the assassination because, as Joan Mellon showed in her book, Farewell to Justice, CIA was heavily involved with the Kennedy assassination. So he had to be, and then it turned out that, you know, Jerry Ford was on the commission. He became president later, but he was an intermediary between Dulles and J. Edgar Hoover, so they get the story straight. And it was a pretty smooth job.
High-ranking cover-up commissions have a long and illustrious history in the United States, I'm afraid.
So Kennedy is still relevant. You know, who killed Kennedy? It still matters.
Yeah, some people think it's all settled, but, you know, I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald was, by all accounts, the worst shot in the world, using the worst gun in the world, with a scope that wasn't even mounted properly, shooting through a tree, which was, in classic tradition, you know, chopped down immediately before it could be turned into evidence.
It's ludicrous on every level.
Kennedy's limousine was gutted after the assassination. They just, you know, burned the entire interior.
Is that right? What was that, to destroy the evidence?
Yeah. It was just, it was due for a refurbishing. didn't let the fact that he had bone chips, you know, splattered all over the interior destroy them from ripping out the entire interior and throwing it away.
It's interesting that Arlen Specter, who I will always think of in terms of the Kennedy assassination because he's the one who invented the single bullet theory, that he finally has exited politics this year.
Mm. Forced out by an angry mob.
he was the genius who contrived that scarcely credible idea that a bullet passed through both Kennedy and Connally,
reverse direction,
right,
and then
was found in a pristine condition on the stretcher.
You guys will probably find this interesting, but I was going to surprise you with this, Ken, but it's relevant now for the conversation. But there's a website called despair.com, and they come up with a lot of satirical calendars and posters and mugs and stuff like that. And they just came out with a make your own mystery book. Remember those old mystery books where, okay, you walk in, there's a murder, and turn to page 27 if you want to investigate, or turn to page 17 if you want to chase the person who's running away, you know?
Right.
All right, so they come out with this book, and it's called Lose Your Own Mystery, and it's about solving the JFK murder, and you're a young junior detective in Dallas who is the son of the police chief.
That's an interesting game.
And the premise is every single choice you make leads to a dead end. But it's, you know, I don't know how many pages the book is. I just ordered one, and it's a two for one. So you get one.
Let me borrow it and you're done.
Yeah, I'll definitely let you borrow it. But there's a snippet up on the website. It's despair.com, and you can read a couple sample pages. And it's really funny because there's an illustration with Arlen Specter explaining to the junior detective how the magic bullet theory works. And there's like a dotted line where it enters one and then like creates seven wounds and bounces around the car. It's really funny.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. But
one of the very few examples of passing the age of 60 is that you realize you've heard this story before. And this story we heard from Kennedy, you know, we've heard another story on, Ken did a show on this, the attack on the U.S. Liberty. They had another high-level investigation of that one. 9/11, they had another high-level investigation of that one. Martin Luther King, did they have an investigation of that one? I don't even... Probably.
Well, they had, yeah.
Murder trial.
Well, they had, yeah, well, James O'Reilly, he confessed and then recanted, and he never could get his day in court. So that's why there was that, the trial that...
They should have waterboarded him.
Right, the trial that they had in the civil court, the civil wrongful death trial.
Which showed that the lone gunman acting alone, who for one reason or another, never make it to trial.
So it seems like our leaders, Eisenhower wanted to make peace. He ended the Korean War, and he really denounced the military-industrial complex. And I think his idea for rapprochement, or his attempt, was knocked out by the U-2 incident, which, as I understand, was set up by the CIA in order to prevent him from meeting with Khrushchev. Kennedy wanted to make peace. But it's since then, since Kennedy was murdered, and Johnson came in and escalated the war, we really have been on this, even with the Democratic presidents, we've been on more and more militarism.
Absolutely.
And this with Obama now, this Obama guy we've got, and it's like Bush, third term Bush.
Absolutely.
You know, we talked to Max Wolf last week, and he talked about the central bank and the Federal Reserve and how it serves such an important role in our economy, which I disagreed with a few things we were talking about, but anyway, the one of the major beefs with the Federal Reserve I have is that they enable the bankrolling of endless war. By having no limit to the amount of money that they can print and create for, and how many bonds they can buy for the government, we can wage war forever without ever having to stop. You know, it used to be that you wage war because you need something or to defend yourself or for, whatever reason. But there's always a point of no return where you got to call everyone back because it ceases to be profitable to be in war. You know, we have to do everything for a profit. There has to be an end game, a reason. There has to be something to justify the fact that you went to war, lost lives. You wagered something in it. But if you don't have to lose anything, if there's nothing to lose, and you can always afford whatever you need.
In fact, war can, if you're a banker and it enlarges the national debt, war is good.
And especially if you're investing in war profiteers.
I mean, sure.
General Electric, how many jet engines and bombs do they make? I mean, of course they're for it.
Yeah, we don't actually have to win a war.
No, you just
In fact, we've never fought a war with anybody that was capable of doing the United States any harm since the 1940s.
That's a good point. We don't pick. It's really almost an excuse to have a war. Let's have a war, and then you can. There's so much money to be made, and I think one of the inadequacies, shall I say, of the peace movement in this country is not to see the connection between that and the banking system.
Right.
And they focus. They say, oh, the banking system, that's somebody else's problem. You know, that's not our issue. But the two are so closely related. If you want to bring democracy back to America, you have to do both. You have to end the war, and you have to we have to break the private banking cartel that controls our economy. Abolish the Federal Reserve and create a debt-free money system controlled by the people.
That's why so many, upper-class liberals are very disingenuous, I feel. You know, I think, like, they're well-meaning. You know, maybe they have their heart in the right place because they want to fight for workers' fair wages and, you know, good working conditions around the world. And, maybe they like peace and they want to end war. But at the same time, they'll go and collect their paycheck from Goldman Sachs and not see the connection. You know, and if you try to attack their upper-middle-class lifestyle where they're very comfortable and they aspire to be even richer one day. You know, maybe one day I'll get that corner office, but they don't understand that with that comes a price. You know, with that upper class lifestyle, you get your comfort. What's that?
That's absolutely right, and I think that there's an insincerity there.
Yeah,
we've got to bring these issues. We got to see that they're both important issues, and you can't have this economic system, which is controlled by corporations, and get peace at the same time.
No, if you could talk to someone about peace, and you'll lose them as soon as you say, but that means that we're gonna have to take it down a notch. You know, we're not gonna be able to consume at the same rate that we are right now.
Well, thanks so much for calling, Ken. When can people listen to your program on JFK? I think you call it JFK Disarmament Crusader.
JFK 1963 Disarmament Crusader. Well, you know, the best way would be to go to my website, where you can find links to an MP3 to download. And
what's the address of your website?
There. It's newworldnotes.blogspot.com.
Okay,
that's great.
newworldnotes.blogspot.com.
Got it. Yeah.
And that show will be available when?
It is available now.
It's available now. Okay, fantastic.
Never done that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ken.
Well, great talking to you again, Ken and Gus.
And we'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Catch you later.
Good night, Ken.
Bye-bye.
All right. That was great.
That was Kennedy's. That was, to me, that was a turning point, that when they knocked off JFK and they got away with it, escalated the war in Vietnam, and we've never looked back.
Yep.
You know, we were talking about alluding to some of the economic issues, and one of the really big stories of the past week has been this QE2, and it's not the ocean liner. It's a $600 billion of what they call quantitative easing, which simply is the Federal Reserve, which we're talking about, just printing money. And I started to add up the amount of money that's been created since the crash in the fall of 2008. Well, you had QE1 and QE2, which is $1.7 trillion. QE2, which is going to be $0.6 trillion. It's $2.3 trillion. This is just funny money that's created by the government going out and buying debt. And they just run the printing presses. Well, actually, they're not physical money. They're just going to be computer entries. But then you add another $700 billion for the TARP bank bailout. Then you've got $800 billion for Obama's stimulus plan, and it came out to $3.8 trillion, and unemployment is just as bad now as it was after the crash.
Did you throw in there the stimulus checks and cash for clunkers?
No, I didn't, unless that's not part of the stimulus package.
No.
That's another little add. So round it off, say $4 trillion. That's a lot of money. Why are people still out of work in this country? If you have any thoughts on that, we'd love to hear your views. Somebody could explain that.
Yeah, if you know the answer.
203-336-9756. Join the conversation here. 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. It's a lot of money. It hasn't made a dent. What's your take on why we're still with 10%? They say 10%, but you know it's higher than that.
No, the number I've heard is actually more like 22%.
Yeah.
It depends where you are in the country, and it depends who you're counting. If you're counting the people who are underemployed, plus unemployed, plus people who have given up looking, discouraged, or the people who've been forced into early retirement, it's 22%.
So it's just grossly understated.
It's close to a quarter of the country is not making enough to get by.
So how can you create $4 trillion and not bring jobs to people?
It's kind of like, just creating $4 trillion. And to give people an idea of how they do that, it's like if I open up my QuickBooks at home and I just put a deposit and I just say the source is myself, and then in the payment number, I just put in $4 trillion and
right.
I just hit enter, and all of a sudden I'm now $4 trillion in the black. You know,
that's some good times with that.
I could buy myself a plasma TV.
Goodbye to the state of Texas.
Buy some nice stuff. A lot of Big Macs. The reason? Because they're just hoarding it for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, the
yeah.
banks, they're just improving their balance sheets. They're not loaning it out to people who are trying to create development or create any kind of production or hire people. No, they say that, if you look at the big time economists at the New York Times, they say we need to raise taxes, and that's how it's going to get things going. And they have to tax the wealthy people, and the Bush tax cuts, that's to blame. You know, give me a break. Come on.
It seems to like a lose-lose situation.
They keep on acting like people, the $250,000 a year, like that's the magic. Is it 250 or is it, what's that number?
For the tax increase?
Yeah, the people under, I think, combined $250,000.
Something like that.
They act like that's really rich. Like, all right, I've never made more than, $45,000 in a year, and that seems like a lot of money to me. But I know that if you own a business, it takes a lot of capital to get that going.
Well, you don't know when they finally come out with it, they always change the goalposts at the last minute.
We have another caller. Go ahead, call.
Good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Good. This is Linda.
Hi, Linda.
I just, it's not kind of like going in what you're talking about, right now with the economy and debt and everything like that. But
okay.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Just earlier tonight, I was thinking about something that I had heard a couple months back in regard to BP's oil catastrophe there
uh-huh.
in the Gulf. There had been a little blurb of information that I heard that had to do with an oceanographic group of individuals. I think they're out of one of the Carolinas. I'm not sure which one, but over there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they went down around, and they discovered a oil slick type, way, you know, way deep in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And they claimed it was from the well, from BP, and they were getting samples, and it was going to be tested. Never heard another word anywhere on anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I my question is, this isn't the first time I've heard little snippets of information in regards to different things, and then it just disappears. So my question is, do you have any information on that? Have you heard that? Has there been any, you know, legitimate follow-up on that investigation? Or?
Well, the exact one that you're referring to, I'm not aware of, but there is, it is known that the well, there's more than one fissure under the ground. They did block up the main one that was the big gusher that everyone saw that was coming up to the surface, but there's a lot of other fissures that continue to hemorrhage and leak, and they are completely unreported. They've put in so much Corexit into the water that it's made it impossible for the oil to rise to the surface, so it just stays below. And it does continue to leak, and it's in the Gulf Stream, you know, just streaming around, but it's not to the level where it was before, where it made a great story. I can't give you anything more clearer than that, other than the reports are still being developed. The science is very difficult to get to because there's such a blockade of information. BP and the government are working together to make sure that there's no independent reporting done. It's very hard to get down to the Gulf to get out there to take some samples or get under the water to get a look.
Okay, because, you know, this is just one of many things that bother me.
Yeah.
about, you know, our government, yeah, and the games they like to play, and that end up ultimately hurting us,
right,
the regular old people. So, as just regular people, like, what would you suggest? You know, write letters, complain. You know,
writing letters is always a good thing. Letters to the editor. You know, in multiple newspapers. I mean, you know, that does help. It gets some like-minded individuals out there to see that they're not alone, and you know, getting into groups, going to public events that you think, like at the library or something like that, where mm-hmm. there's going to be, you know, maybe say 100, 150 people who are going to be there, and just get up and ask a question, be brave, and try to ask a public official. You know, like sometimes Jim Himes will go to like the Greenwich Library or something like that, and he's your elected representative, to go out there and bravely ask him point blank, and watch him squirm, you know, see that he won't answer.
That's
right. You.
That's right, because we may not control the corporate media, but you can at the grassroots level.
And you can make them look like a fool in front of 150 people, where they're going to wonder, why didn't he answer that question?
Yes. And also, I just realized that you also were speaking of people's responses to the war, the ongoing war.
Yeah.
And how it's kind of like, you know, you asked, like, one of the, how, you know, people in the neighborhood, you know, what the talk was when that came up. And individuals just kind of like, oh, I don't know. And,
yeah.
You know, just all kind of blasé about the whole thing
mm-hmm.
These days. And with that in mind, why do a lot of people just not care anymore?
It's a lot of work.
I think it may also have to do with the draft.
Yeah.
Because during Vietnam, we had the draft, and a lot of people were afraid they were going to be sent.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's a big point.
And college students today, they're understandably worried about the fact they're being crushed with college tuition costs, which are obscenely high.
Yes.
And that something should be done about that. So, you know, I don't think...
Yeah, they'd rather pay tuition than get shot.
Yeah, and they're just so worried about their economic future that the war just seems like, you know...
It's far away. It's on the other side of the planet.
It's a concern.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, whatever coverage we get is really, really minimal. I mean, how about, like, you know, Bush putting out that blockade of showing the dead soldiers, remember?
Yeah. Oh, yes, right. Yeah. Yes.
And that's they said they weren't allowed to print
sanitize
the photos.
Sanitize the war, yeah.
Yeah. Right now. Well, I know, you know, if I remember correctly, back during the Vietnam War, that, you know, having it up close and on your TV and in people's faces, you know,
Every week you'd see it right from the front. And I think, unfortunately, one of the things that the powers that be learned is never to let that happen again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They learned a lesson there.
Which, you know, I mean, I think that people see that kind of stuff. You know, it makes things a little bit, they're thinking a little bit different.
You know, also our war protesters, we were talking a few minutes ago about, you know, how to get the peace protesters involved. And you say when you start talking about the economical part, then they you lose them. The peace movement in this country is so watered down.
Yes.
You know, we don't have peace activists on TV news. You know, if you know, there's groups like Code Pink and stuff like that. Like they, you know, they protest the war, but they ignore like the biggest war crimes.
That's right. It's been so marginalized, the peace movement.
And they get donations from, you know, a group, and just like the Sierra Club or something like that. They'll get a big donation from an oil company.
Right.
And then say, you can protest, you know, whaling.
Right, right.
But don't protest, you know, like the North Slope of Alaska or something like that, because we need it. You know?
So stay on that side
of the
street.
It's a payoff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Stay on that side of the street, right. Exactly.
And yeah, and I don't see the peace, certainly it's not visible. The peace movements aren't visible in the corporate media.
I mean, no, the peace activists, they supported Obama during the campaign, but as soon as he came into office and he expanded the war, they're like, hey, whatever, we're in charge now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I wasn't fooled by Obama, because I listened carefully during the campaign to what he was saying.
Yep. No, he backed off in his stances as he
got
closer.
And I listened to his military advisors, and they said they were going to expand the war in Pakistan. They said, we're going into Pakistan. And I said, this doesn't sound like a guy who's going to end the war.
No.
No.
And you look at where his money's coming from.
Yeah.
You know?
Goldman Sachs.
Well, that's it, you know, all that money, and you got to pay it back.
Exactly.
Way.
These guys aren't Boy Scouts.
Yep. Somebody, you got to pay it back somehow.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for the call, Linda.
With us. Thank you, guys.
Call again.
Good night.
Good night.
So we were talking about the economy, and I have an article here from CNSNews.com, and the headline is, I'll hold it up for you. Bankruptcy of U.S. is mathematical certainty, says former CEO of nation's 10th largest bank.
Wow.
Mathematical certainty.
we're in tough shape.
Can't argue with the numbers.
One of the symptoms of our precarious economic position is not just the huge deficits, but it's the threat to the dollar. Of course, since the end of World War II, the U.S. dollar has been essentially the world reserve currency. It was pegged to the gold for until 1971, and then we went off the gold. But still, people trade in dollars. So if people want to buy oil, central banks have to keep a lot of dollars in their vaults in order to pay for their oil.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, China and Japan each have almost $1 trillion worth of U.S. debt. And if the U.S. dollar should cease to become the world's reserve currency, we're really in the soup. And earlier this year, both Russia and China said, hey, the dollar shouldn't be the world reserve currency. We should have a basket of currency. And I saw just last week, it was reported on the UK Independent that South Korea Central Bank is looking to put more money into gold. So people are moving away from the dollar, or the countries slowly.
Mm-hmm.
China and other countries are trading, bartering, avoiding the dollar. China, Brazil, China, Russia, China, Turkey. So they're trying to move off the dollar. And should that day come, and I think it will come in this decade, maybe within the next 3 or 4 years, we are going to be in tough shape.
You know that gold and silver are the big indicators. And in the day after QE2 was announced, gold shot up and so did silver.
That's right.
And the dollar index dropped. But the stock market went up because, you know, the big banks, they love it. It's more money in their pockets.
And, you know, I understand a lot of that money is going into foreign investments. They're taking that money that they're getting at 0%, and they're putting it into foreign currencies, into foreign, you know, buying foreign assets. And, you know, some people have said that the financial elite may do to the American middle class, or is doing to the American middle class, what it did to third world countries in the 1980s. Essentially, it's going to loot this place.
Mm-hmm.
And if the dollar collapses, I believe they're going to know the day before.
Yeah, well, they're going to know the day before.
You and I are going to get stuck with the bill.
And whatever the replacement for the dollar is going to be, you know, because they're going to have to create a new currency.
Yeah.
They're going to be in it. They're going to have the first run off the press.
Sure. Yeah,
you know, they're still going to be warm, and they're going to be in their pockets.
That's
and
right.
The next day, they're going to go on a bank holiday, and they're not going to let you get your money out of the bank. And they're going to say
when the
limit withdrawals to like $50.
And the dust settles, they'll come back to the United States with currency that's now buy everything cheap.
Right.
And that's what happened in places like Argentina. You're talking about the how the banks are making out. excuse me, Gus, I just got a notice from American Express. Now,
yeah,
the big banks are getting money at close to 0%.
Right.
I can get a cash advance from American Express for 25.24%.
Oh, is that all?
Is that just, that's all.
So you,
that's a,
wow.
That's a modest markup.
So how much are you going to get?
I think I'll charge to the hilt. Now, I used to practice law. When I started practicing law, the only kind of people who could charge interest like that were people
loan
who,
sharks.
They had broke your legs to get, right? It was against the law.
People who
New
could
York
force
State,
you to pay
where
back,
I was.
Right.
Yeah. And they repealed the usury laws, and now they get away with this stuff, and it's really amazing, and people put up with it. But
you know what?
Snookered here.
This is the same. You know what's ironic is that this is the same practice that economic hitmen have done in other third world countries since the 60s.
That's right.
But now they're doing it on our own people because they've run out of suckers.
Well, you know, metaphorically speaking, people say, well, our elite, our government might murder people abroad,
mm-hmm.
but they never would have pulled off 9/11 as a false flag.
Right. No,
they wouldn't
not.
Kill Americans.
No.
They might, you know, wipe out people in some other country, but not here. But, you know, I think money's money, and that's about it.
Money's money, and people are scum. You know, they look at people, not just Americans,
right.
as just dumb filth. And they divide themselves not by national borders, but by elitist level accomplishments.
That's right.
You know, like
that's right.
What club they're a part of, you
yeah.
know, or what level of elitism have they reached. And it has nothing to do with your national allegiance. You could be British or Austrian or German or
that's
Japanese.
Right.
It doesn't matter. They're all in the same club. You know, like the G20, like all those guys get together with a secret handshake or the Bilderberg Group or something like that. You know, it doesn't matter what language they're what passport they hold. You know, the regular guys, the common folk.
We are not at the table.
We're all ants.
That's right. And I think it's a very difficult abstraction for the American public to get a hold of.
No, because they're raised with, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And, you know, when you walk around, you may argue with people, but we're all Americans. We're
yeah.
all neighbors. And when
yeah.
you leave the country, that becomes apparent because you're by yourself. If you
That's
go
right.
to Mexico or something. And I don't mean just like, you know, right over the border. I mean, you know, way down or way South America or something
yeah.
like that. You're alone.
Yeah.
And when you come back, you know, you're like, wow, man, I really appreciate this place.
And it is a great country, but we shouldn't allow these guys to run us the way they do, whether it's Obama or Bush or this, what Nader calls it. It's one monster with two heads.
Mm.
And, you know, listeners may know that Gus and I have come kind of not exactly from the same end of the spectrum.
Right.
I'd say, Gus, it's fair to say you're more Republican, I'm more Democrat.
If you want to confine it to those
words.
If you want
to look at it that way,
yeah.
with a heavy dose of libertarianism thrown in there.
Yeah.
But it's not a left-right issue. It's a question of whether people govern this country or whether large corporations govern this country in their own for their own profit.
You know, I've come, you know, since you mentioned it, I've come a long way in a short time. You know, I was watching something on 9/11 last night. It was on History Channel or something like that. It was something I had recorded a while back in my DVR, and I never got a chance to watch it because, you know, when 9/11 comes around, I get so upset about it. I have to save the propaganda to sort through it later, you know?
Right, exactly.
I always save these things and I watch them like a month later or something
right.
because I don't have the stomach for it at
yeah,
that time.
It can be very...
It's unnerving, trying. You know? So there was a show that I watched and it was... what the heck was it? It was The Man Who Predicted 9/11 and it was
yes.
about the security chief of Dean Witter.
Right.
And it was all about how he predicted 9/11 and he was trying to get the building to be more secure and stuff like that. I'm like, man, there are a lot of people who predicted 9/11. It wasn't just the security guard at Dean Witter. You know, I mean, there were people who analyzed that stuff who watched the telltale signs. There's a lot of guys. Alex Jones is one of them who went on the air the summer before September 11th and said, you know, don't do it because we know you're going to do it. We know you're getting ready for it.
What were the signs that he was
It was the chatter of just they were starting to put the patsies out there. They were starting to get the word about Osama bin Laden, look around for the terrorism, you know, and the threat level and you know,
it is interesting how they and I had forgotten that, Gus, but you see the same thing now with say Yemen and they're putting out there's going to be more bombings in the last few months. Oh,
yeah.
Europe's on high alert. There are going to be more bombings in Europe.
And then it happens.
And then it happens.
You know, like we had the big terror threat alert that was before the toner cartridge bombs.
Yeah.
You know, and that was for weeks they got that ready.
That's right.
And then, boom, it happened, and all of a sudden, everybody's in a tizzy.
We told you. And that's why I think it's so important for the listeners to take a look at 9/11. Take a look at, it's like the shows we did with Stephen Jones, the physicist. And you can hear these shows for free. Just go to our website, incontextreport.com. Mm-hmm. This chat show was done with History Counts. We also did a show with the David Ray Griffin, who's probably the two of them, the leading 9/11 investigators. And you can see that the evidence is just overwhelming that these were false flag operations. And once you understand that, then everything else starts to fall into place.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I brought that up is going a long way in a short time was that, on September 11th and the year after, I was a big Republican.
Yeah.
I bought it, you know, and the only part that I needed to know about my worldview was that Reagan was our best president ever.
Right.
And that the Democrats were the cause of everything bad that happened in the country.
It's a pretty simple analysis.
It's pretty simple, but I still think a lot of people live that way.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, it wasn't until after 9/11 happened that my whole mind just blew up.
Right, right.
You know, when I started to look into it because I had questions about the way it happened.
Right.
And it was probably like 2003 that I started to have real questions. It took about a year and a half.
Yes, I think for me as well. And by the way, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, looks like we may have a little more time. So we're at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. You're welcome to give us a call and talk about just any subject that's of concern to you relating to public affairs, whether it's the economy, the war, or the recent election. And we're right here at WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org.
And so one of the things that I learned about quickly after 9/11, because I was like, well, if this happened, you know, and I didn't believe all of it. I was like, well, you know, maybe they knew some stuff was going to happen, but they didn't know this. And well, the building must have fell down by accident. Like they couldn't have possibly anticipated that was going to happen.
Right.
And then it was later, well, they couldn't possibly have wanted the building to fall, could they? And then it was, you know, well, maybe I believe the terrorists really did hijack the plane. And then the other stuff, maybe they just took advantage of afterward. And it's like one thing after another, it evolves into it, you know, and then finally I was like, well, what else is messed up out there that I thought was normal? And, you know, it was how many other times are there staged terror? Like, really, other countries have done it? You know, and like the Reichstag fire and how many other things?
How about the Gulf of Tonkin?
I learned about all these things I had never heard of before. I didn't even know what the Gulf of Tonkin was.
Of course, that was a 1964 staged event off the coast of Vietnam, which created the pretext for the escalation in Vietnam. And they have Lyndon Johnson on tape saying, to a tape recording in the Oval Office saying, you lied to me about the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah.
You knew it was a lie.
And then more recently, the border wars with Mexico, you know, learning about how when you want to take advantage of a situation, you hype it up, you throw gas on the fire, and then you sell people the water to put it out.
That's right.
And it's your own brand of water, right?
Right.
So just recently, you know, in case people don't believe it, the border war is going on between us and the Mexican drug gangs. You know, what's his name? Is it Calderon?
Yes.
I forget who's currently in charge. Vicente Fox was before. Then Calderon is in charge. And, you know, he's come over here and lectured us about how we need to ban guns and how we need to continue the drug war and, you know, we're the cause for their problems. You know, we need to help them out. Well, I got news for you. We're selling, the military is selling the drug gangs the guns.
Is that right?
All right. The Mexican military uses German-made weapons, H&K, Heckler & Koch, machine guns. The drug gangs down there are not using AR-15s and M-16s from America. They're using HKs. They have grenades. They have grenade launchers, rocket launchers. This is not stuff that you can go down to your gun store
and
buy. You know, these are not 12 gauges. These are not 308s, 22s. These are not anything that the consumer can buy without heavy, heavy licensing, akin to your local military.
So how are the drug gangs getting these weapons?
So Germany sells the guns to the Mexican military, and the military is so corrupt, they just take the guns right out the back door, and they just mark them up, and they sell them on the black market. And then here's a report from San Diego AP, and this happened in Colorado. Government prosecutors have asked a federal judge to deny bail to a Navy SEAL accused of smuggling assault rifles from Iraq into U.S. for sale and shipment to Mexico.
No.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Robert S. Huey told the judge Friday that Nicholas Bickle is a flight risk and dangerous. Bickle remained in custody. Bickle is accused of conspiring with a Colorado man and a Las Vegas associate to smuggle and sell weapons to an undercover federal agent in Nevada and Colorado. Officials say federal agents seized 5 pounds of C4 military-grade explosives from the Colorado home of Richard Paul. So, I'll just summarize the rest of it. He took machine guns manufactured in Iraq and smuggled them back into the United States, and then took and he had many more things, including grenades and C4 military explosives, and had made contacts with the black market, and was going to be heading up a smuggling ring with machine guns that they were going to be selling to Mexico. And this is a Navy SEAL, so we don't even know if this was under directive because of a covert operation, because these guys are usually searched before they leave
Iraq. What is the American government, or
he had U-Hauls full
of this stuff. What does our government want to see? Do we want to see Mexico disintegrate so that we can take it over? What's the game plan? I'm wondering, because the place in Mexico is it? It's really
the basket case. I don't know. It's a good question, but it's dragging us down. You know, because we're the ones that fund it. We have the drug war here.
You're right.
That raises the price of drugs. So when you have marijuana that's illegal, marijuana, which, you know, the lowest of all of them, the most common, and is very expensive for what it is, something you can grow in your garage. It's a weed.
Right.
Literally a weed. It's where the name comes from. You can go to jail for the possession of it and dealing it. So that creates a black market. It raises the price so much that you actually have a reason to have a turf war over it.
Sure.
And all that money just gets sent right back to Mexico, supporting the drug lords. And, you know, there's a lot of undercover reporting that goes on that says that the Mexican government is one of the biggest drug lords in the entire country, and that the drug wars that are going on down there are between the official drug industry and the other
rival gangs
that are trying to...
Yeah. That makes sense to me, because I can understand why a sensible Mexican wouldn't want to get involved in it.
Why not? I mean,
because you're just going to get nailed.
I mean, and the country's a disarmed country. They don't have legal guns there.
Yeah.
So,
which shows you that gun control isn't necessarily the path.
And if you want to protect yourself, you need to get in with the drug gangs.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just. Like we said, an ant. You're nothing. You're free game.
So how is the situation going to evolve? Because it doesn't seem like the Mexican people are ready to go to some kind of military dictatorship to end it. I'm surprised at their patience, because I would think by now they would just be picking some strong man who's just going to do what Mao did in China, which he just shot all the drug dealers.
Well, I mean, the old way that they used to have their police departments was just that, you know, it would rise up out of the need.
Yeah.
You know, like before there were official police departments, there was just local strongmen who just offered protection.
Yes.
You know, it was like the mafia, like the police department was so corrupt. Like the mob, they wouldn't go to you and protect you if you had a call. Like the mob would rise up in the Italian neighborhoods in New York where the police wouldn't go.
So the mob has become the de facto government of Mexico.
Yeah.
So what is that going to come? How much is that going to spill over here? I mean, the drug money is immense. I wonder to what extent the drug money is going to start to
subvert
our institutions.
Well, was it Prop 19 in California? Proposition 19, I think it was, or 13. We saw that fail on election day. Narrowly.
I was surprised. I thought with their financial crisis, the bankruptcy, California bankruptcy, that they would vote for it, figuring it'd be a revenue source, and what the heck, you know, the marijuana is not that big a problem anyway.
Right. I mean, we already saw that Schwarzenegger just arbitrarily reduced it from a felony to a misdemeanor?
Yeah, I think it's like a park.
Or an infraction?
Yeah, it's a very
minor. From a misdemeanor to an infraction.
Very minor crime now.
And it's It's on level with a parking ticket.
Something like that, yeah. And so why not? So why didn't they vote for it? Maybe
I don't know.
There's got to be a lot of money and wanting to keep it illegal.
Exactly right. Wouldn't that beg for you to ask the question? Well, let's see. They could make money legally by making it legal. They could also regulate it and keep it safe,
right,
so that people wouldn't be taking it laced with LSD or heroin,
right,
and dying off of it,
right,
and kids getting hooked on some harder drugs or something like that. Whatever. You could say, you know, make it like alcohol. So you have to go to this whatever store and you buy it, but you have to be over 18. And
maybe it's a bizarre alliance.
They could tax it.
A bizarre alliance between the dope dealers and well-intentioned people who are more on the puritanical side, who say, who don't want, you know, they just feel some moral.
But why are those puritanical people led to believe that it's so awful? I mean, I know someone who's a police officer, and he happens to be, I'm not going to say what town he's in or his name or anything like that. I doubt he would like that. but he's on the drug enforcement team,
right,
and he works with the feds and all that kind of stuff. And we talk every once in a while, and I'm like, you know that it's not dangerous. I mean, look, all right, this is personally, I have never, ever smoked marijuana, okay? I'm being totally honest. I've never tried any drug in my life.
So what is his response?
But I like alcohol, but I don't smoke. I don't smoke cigarettes. I've never smoked a cigar, anything, all right? I don't have a problem with marijuana. That's a choice.
So what is this, the policeman's attitude?
I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay. You're in the clear.
he's like, it's a gateway drug, man. You know, I was like, what was the worst thing that could happen if we legalized marijuana? Oh, you'd have people strung out all over the place.
Is that right?
Really? Seriously?
I don't think so.
I mean, you know, like the biggest fear is that people's kids will try marijuana if they make it legal. They're trying it now.
Yeah,
I mean, there's
yeah.
nothing to stop them. Greenwich High School, you know, we're both from Greenwich. Greenwich High School has an epidemic with marijuana to the point where they have drug dogs checking people's lockers. And that's an affluent neighborhood,
yes,
right? Greenwich is one of the wealthiest towns in, like, the country.
Right.
And it has a major drug problem. And it's not just marijuana. It's other hard drugs because kids have a lot of money. They have access to money. And they have a lot of free time and, like, very little ambition. So,
but now you've got to – let's say we put the marijuana aside and we say, okay, we legalize that because it really isn't that damaging. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the hard drugs, you got the cocaine and the heroin, and those industries will continue to flourish,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's a harder case because they're highly addictive.
Right.
What do you do about that? Because you can't want to waste your time. Well, you know, put a lot of users in jail. Seems like an awful waste of your public resources.
It's entirely like how much money is it? Like $30,000 how much is it to put someone in jail?
I think it's more than 30, and it's more. It's, I think it's cost. It's probably as much as it costs to send somebody to a private college.
I think it costs
50
like
to 100.
I think it costs like $20,000 a year to educate a student, and like $30,000 to put a kid in jail for marijuana.
It's more to put somebody in jail, and that's craziness. But then you have, like, let's say, cocaine and heroin, which destroys people's lives. You don't want the state in any way to appear sanctioning it.
Right.
So I don't know how you deal with that.
I mean, that's an interesting topic to me. I think addiction, you know, is something I have personal experience with. Not myself. I already mentioned I've never done drugs.
Right.
but it's something that if you're an addict, and by what I mean, if you're an addict, not that you've been addicted to a drug, but an addict just is.
Right.
All right. You're an addict even before you've done it.
Yeah.
Once you find it, you're hooked and you can never get off of it because that's just who you are.
You mean addictive personality.
You're an addictive personality. You're an alcoholic or a drug addict or cigarettes, you know, whatever it is, amphetamines, caffeine, because you're someone who needs it. All right. The only way to get over that is like personal revelation. You know, you need to seek something to replace that in your life, something else constructive to be addicted to. An addictive personality is always going to find it. And I was watching something with my wife last week, and it was on heroin addiction. And it was three case studies. They followed these three teens. You know, this one girl, or not teen, I mean, like 18 to 22 or something like that. And so they were like college age, and, you know, they'd all dropped out and were just doing absolutely nothing with themselves. And one girl was getting money from her parents, and they were paying for it, you know, and they just figured she was depressed. You know, she was addicted to heroin. She was smoking heroin. She was going out twice a day to meet her dealer, and, you know, like, she had this whole system. And
it's horrible.
And they asked one of the kids, they said, what would have happened if you'd never found heroin? You know, because they asked all three of the kids, and two of them were like, well, I'd be in college now. The one was like, oh, I'd be in my dad's pipe fitting business. And the other one's like, nothing would have stopped me. I would have found it no matter what.
Yeah.
I dream about it. I want it all the time. It's all I can think about. Even before I tried it, I wanted it.
So how, that's suicidal when,
totally.
when it's well known that it destroys your life.
Yeah. And we want to try prohibition in this country to like beat somebody straight. You know, like you're going to bust them, beat them, put them in jail with other drug addicts. And they're just going to sit there and stew about how much they hate you for stopping them from doing something they love. And they're just going to scheme up new ways when they get out to get it again or get it when they're in jail.
What do you think that perhaps that there's something wrong that fundamentally are the way we run our society with all the pressure and the materialism that it's alien to the way we are as human beings, alien to our nature. And then we seek outlets and self-destructive behavior.
Man, I don't know.
I mean, it's the individuals are certainly a lot, you know, we all have free will. But on the other hand, we seem to be living in a society that's values are upside down. It's kind of mad profit-driven society where people are ground down. You know, they're treated like cogs in a machine, and that sometimes you know they just break and they look for an escape from.
We're supposedly the greatest country in the world, and as I mentioned before, I love this country. You know, I talked about going to South America and then coming back and just being happy to be here. Our values are completely upside down because we are the most overweight country in the world. We're the most stressed out country in the world for being a first world nation. You know, we have some of the lowest quality of life. I mean, our income disparity is, what is it, 800-1 from the CEOs to the common laborers?
In the Western world, there's nothing like
There's nothing like that anywhere. And all we want to do is export our way of life so that we can sell blue jeans and coffee and Diet Coke to Afghanis.
And, you know, somehow
what do they
people
want
who
that
reject
for?
This value system are viewed as socialists or whatever. It's not about socialism. It's about human values, what kind of life you want, you know, which is to be, have leisure time, spend time with your family, you know, have rewarding work.
However you want to spend your life.
However you want to spend it. Have personal freedom. These are the things that I think everybody wants, but the people at the top don't want it. They're only driven by one thing, which is maximizing short-term profit. That's it. They don't care what happens to the human environment or the physical environment. It doesn't matter. And it's a self-destructive mentality.
It's gain profit. It's power. I think power is their aphrodisiac.
Yes.
You know, and it's expelling influence forcefully over someone else.
Yes.
It's making someone do what you want them to do.
I look at the people who caused these wars, like the Iraq War, like I look at Bush and Cheney. I said, these men have all the money they need.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they doing this? What's this about? They convince themselves it's their patriotic duty. But we know it's about the lust for power.
Yeah.
And it's like a disease.
I mean, it has nothing to do with money. I mean, they have all the money that they need, you know, and obviously there's, you know, they come from these family empires where, you know, they obviously, like Bush, he looks back to his grandfather Prescott, and you know, if it wasn't for him, George W. Bush would be nowhere. He'd be a nothing.
That's right.
So he understands the importance of family empire and setting up something for his grandchildren. So, you know, I definitely think that they know that they have to keep the empire
going.
They
want to be in the club. And as Kevin Phillips wrote a great history of the Bush family, and I didn't realize that they really are kind of the robber baron, arms dealing.
Oh, yeah.
Right from day one, they were sort of junior partners to the Rockefellers back at Buckeye Steel in Ohio back in the late 1800s. And your company didn't get to have its oil. How did it work? Rockefeller wouldn't do business with you basically unless you bought your steel from Buckeye Steel.
Uh-huh.
So they were tied in together with the Bushes and the Rockefellers. And, they got into the arms business in the early 20th century and the CIA. And these guys have just been cruising along with that incrad ever since. You know, you talked about going to, about a Jim Himes meeting. And I took a look, and Jim Himes, of course, was narrowly reelected. As he finished his first term, he was reelected in this recent election for a second term as U.S. Congress. And I said, well, you know, who really supports Jim Himes? You know, what does he really stand for? So I said, well, one indication would be, where does he get his money from? So I went to opensecrets.org, and I said, let's see where the money comes from. And the top contributor to Jim Himes is the General Electric Company, $48,000. Number two, Goldman Sachs. Then Brown Brothers Harriman. Then we go down. We got Credit Suisse. We've got Bank of America and Deutsche Bank, Price Waterhouse, and so forth. These are the guys who paid for Jim Himes' campaign. And he's a Democrat, and the Democrats have a great tradition of being the party of the people, going back to Jefferson and Jackson. But pardon me, Goldman Sachs, for whom Jim Himes was once a vice president, that's not the people as far as I'm concerned.
No, I'm sorry. I had to go answer the door. I missed a lot of what you just said.
But we're talking about the people who supported Jim Himes financially in his campaign. And General Electric Company, of course, it's finance. Headquarters is in his district.
Right.
And Goldman Sachs.
Absolutely.
You know, he was a VP for Goldman Sachs. Well, you know, the check is cleared, right?
Uh-huh.
Who is he looking out for? I'm sure he's a nice family guy. I'm sure he's good to his wife.
Did you mention he was a former employee of Goldman Sachs?
Sure, yeah, VP of Goldman Sachs. But he's part of the system. I don't expect very much that. How can you expect him to be anything but what he's, you know, but the people who've given him money?
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Obama. The money is so corrupting in our system. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, because we now have this phenomena of these what they call 501c4 nonprofits, mm-hmm. which are throwing in even more money. These are direct contributions from employees of these corporations. We have these issues-oriented groups and these nonprofits, which have been encouraged due to recent Supreme Court rulings, and they can raise money, unlimited amounts of money from people, and the donors can be anonymous. So we don't even know who's flooding these campaigns with money anymore. So, you know, democracy is a great thing, but it looks to me like it's been pretty well corrupted by money.
Well, no, and that's our chief export, right? Democracy.
You're right.
That's what we're trying to spread.
That's presumably why we're in the war.
And if you look at that and that's democracy, do I really want to spread that around the world? I mean, why would I want to make anyone suffer under that?
I don't know how you take the money out of it, but tell me, what do you think of this idea, Gus? Is that you just ban TV advertising for political campaigns, and you say all the stations...
No one would vote.
all the stations, as part of their license, we go back to the idea that stations have to provide news.
Yeah.
And that every station has got to provide a platform. Every candidate gets a chance to be in debates, or maybe on his own time also gets to present his position. No more paid advertising. So that people are not, they don't have their minds, you don't have this mad race for money to buy advertising time.
There are a lot of ways to redo this. Would that mean that there'd be like 45 candidates at every debate, though?
Well,
I mean, there has to be some kind of a minimum, right?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to have some sort of a.
I don't like the way they do it now, where they say you have to be polling at like 10%.
Well, no, that's terrible.
Obviously that's stupid.
I think that the certainly the process of getting on the ballot is simple, is so onerous that I don't think it ever.
Oh no, it's designed to keep you off.
It's
the
designed
ballot.
To keep you off. So I don't think there are going to be that many people. I was surprised to see. I just happened to look at the procedure for getting on the ballot in New York State if you wanted to run in a presidential primary. And as I recall, you had to get X number of I think this was the Republican rules, and each party has its own rules. You had to get so many signatures, a lot of signatures. But even after you got the signature, the party leaders could decide not to let you on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
If they decided you weren't really a candidate, and that was determined by how much national coverage your campaign was given.
Right.
So this is ridiculous.
Wait, this is for the presidential?
The presidential primary in New York State.
Yeah.
So I think that's why Stephen Colbert wasn't allowed to run in his home state of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had no trouble getting the petition. I think he would have gotten a lot of votes, but the party leaders said...
They just decided that he wasn't viable.
We don't think he should be a candidate.
Yeah. So come on, you're a comedian. You're not really serious.
Exactly. I think he would have done very well, and I think he would have done well.
Do you remember during the last presidential election, during the Republican primaries, Ron Paul was not allowed to be in the first primary because the Republican committee decided that he was not a legitimate
Is
candidate?
Is that right?
There was protest, there was petitions, and there were calls into... who ran it? Was it Fox? I think, who the televised...
This was the first debate.
The first debate.
Right.
And then he was on the second one because the people complained.
And I remember at the conclusion of that debate, they had a call-in, a poll. I believe it was that debate.
Yeah.
Who do you think performed best?
Yeah, he won.
He won, but then the commentator completely undermined his victory by essentially dismissing him as a flake, that this phone thing meant nothing. It was
Sean Hannity.
It was so dismissive that it's very powerful when the anchor guy who's wearing the pants and the white coat says, well, of course, Ron Paul, ha ha ha, he's not a serious candidate, make fools of all the people who called up for him. And actually Ron Paul represents probably the real conservative point of view in this country. And maybe you say Dennis Kucinich represents the real liberal. And here are these guys who really are where the people are at on the, you might say, the two sides of the popular issues. And they're marginalized. The American people is told by the media they you can't vote for them. You got to vote for one of these corporate errand boys who's been bought and paid for.
Right. Now, and I remember watching that because I had never heard of Ron Paul before. I heard before the first debate that he wasn't allowed on, and I wanted to know why, because I hadn't made up who I was going to vote for. I had made up my mind. I wanted to hear everybody. I wanted to hear the whole field. And by them deciding arbitrarily that I was not allowed to hear what he had to say, made me immediately
think that he probably had something important to say.
Which
he does, because he takes on the war.
Exactly.
He's a Republican, and he takes on the war. And he cites Dwight Eisenhower the Republican tradition of staying out of foreign
wars. He was the only one on the panel who got up there and said, the war is ridiculous. We need to leave them alone. You know, we're over there just rattling a hornet's nest. And why do you think we have suicide bombers? You know, because they hate us. We need to stop. And it's costing us so much money, and it's killing so many people, and it's bringing back our soldiers damaged. We can't pay for their health care. And he just was like, I was just like, yeah.
This guy's right on. It was all the networks could do, is to control this, to keep him from breaking out, becoming a viable candidate.
And then even afterward, the damage control was so pathetic, because it was Fox News who was doing, I think, the debate, the Republican debate. And Sean Hannity and Combs, they were there at the time. They were still a pair. And I guess it was their routine to interview the poll winner.
Right.
The people's winner. They interviewed Ron Paul, and he was so rude and dismissive. First of all, to an elder. I mean, you're not just rude to someone who's older than you. I'm taught manners, I'm not just going to sit there and just berate someone who's older than me just because I'm taught to respect my elders. But
this is the journalist who was interviewing him.
Sean Hannity's not a journalist.
Oh, okay.
Don't be so kind. and it was, he was being so dismissive, and Ron Paul was trying to talk about history, and Hannity was like, let me educate you. He said that three times.
Oh my God.
And you can still find this on YouTube. He goes, let me educate you.
But of course, the audience is being influenced by this.
Well, Hannity looked like he was very nervous.
Yeah.
So I was being influenced, thinking that, wow, he's embarrassed. Like, he doesn't know what to say.
He doesn't know what to say. But to a lot of people...
But he knows that he's supposed to do something demeaning. He doesn't know
that's
what.
That's right.
But he obviously got
his orders to make Ron Paul, to try to diminish
his Don't let him
success.
Get his truth out or whatever.
Well, I think that Ron Paul taps into a strong libertarian strain in America.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from his being against the war, I think, then that's what the Tea Party people are trying to kind of hijack that part of his message. And I think it is a hijacking, because they don't carry the key parts of the message. I think they're being used, a lot of them. But there is this libertarian streak that they respond to.
Be specific with the Tea Party, because you did some research into the Tea Party.
Sure,
because it's not just like the Tea Party thing, like kind of.
The Party thing was
so general.
It
doesn't speak for anybody.
It was Rick Santella back in February.
I was watching when it happened.
Me too. I happen to have CNBC on, and Rick Santella, listeners, you may know him as he's an important figure at CNBC. He reports every day from Chicago and the commodities markets. And he was waving his arms around and denouncing Obama's attempt to provide mortgage relief.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why this is such a terrible issue for a bunch of rich people that, people losing their houses should be getting help. Yeah. But he was exercised about it, and he said, we need a Tea Party movement in this country. And the very next day, voila, There are websites for the Tea Party movement paid for by Freedom Works, which is a very pro-business lobbying organization run by Dick Armey, a top Republican leader in the House of Representatives, who's now, I believe, a lobbyist himself. So we're this is not a coincidence. And then Fox News almost immediately picks up the Tea Party, and they start pushing, and a woman named Michelle Malkin is writing about it on her Fox blog, right? And so, hey, this stuff is not grassroots. This is was the appearance of a grassroots movement. Now, there are millions of people out there who are you know, upset about the huge deficits and about taxes. Okay, understandable. Nobody likes the high taxes, and everybody should be concerned about the deficits. And these guys cynically, I think, harness their anger and they steer it in a way that's useful to them, which is deregulate business, you know, and lower marginal taxes on wealthy people. And they leave behind, and actually the phrase Tea Party was really started by Ron Paul's people at his fundraisers. So they hijacked this tiny part of it, which is deregulation, and they leave out stopping the war, which is critical, and ending the Federal Reserve, which is also critical to Ron Paul.
But to be fair, though, you can – the Tea Party is a collection of – it's like bring your own issue. At least it was.
It was, but I think at the top – you look at Dick Armey and Freedom Works and the Koch family, which is these billionaires in oil, gas, and chemicals who finance Freedom Works. You've got Russo Marsh, which is a conservative pro-Bush Republican PR firm in California, which organized the Tea Party Express. So the strings of this are being pulled by, I think, top corporate types in the Republican Party with the objective of moving the whole debate in this country towards a pro-business model, taking the important issues like the Federal Reserve and money and the war off the table. And they did a really good job of it.
Because the first few Tea Party events, and I know I immediately jumped online and I, you know, got on the mailing list for something because I wanted to see what this is about, the Tea Party thing. And I know that the first couple events, which were scheduled for New York City, I don't even think they happened. I think like they tried to get momentum into it, but they didn't happen. And then later on, it just grew into this gigantic nationwide movement. So I think that the grassroots thing kind of fizzled, but the machine
at the top
got behind it and said, this is a great idea.
And I mean, every day you hear it on, you know, you can't get, Stephen Jones can't get on TV, the most important scientist in the 9/11 truth movement. He can't get on TV for love or money to talk about the fact that the evidence that the 9/11 was a false flag operation. But every day you're seeing Tea Party this and Tea Party that.
And originally, I think the issues were end the Fed, end the wars, lower taxes. You know, obviously the health care bill was a big thing. And it was, you know, listen to us. It was, we want to have representation.
But what happened to the war issue and the Federal Reserve issue?
That stuff just disappeared. Because once they got in Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich, and once Glenn Beck started hosting his own events, and it was Sean Hannity, and they just jumped behind it. And then all of a sudden,
they hijacked it.
You know, because they draw a lot of people. And if you have an End the Fed rally with, like, you know, 15,000 people, and then all of a sudden Sean Hannity shows up, you're going to get 150,000 people who love war.
That's right.
And just don't even know about the Federal Reserve. So all of a sudden the whole issue changes.
So how do you – I mean, I just don't know how you get a genuine grassroots movement off the ground in this country.
Man.
When the media is controlled by the same corporate interests that, you know, pay for the political campaigns and pay for the lobbyists that design our legislation.
That's really hard to do because
– chicken or egg.
Yeah. Without terrestrial broadcast, you know, because you could have satellite or you could have shortwave or you could have internet broadcasts and you could talk about whatever you want. You could even get 150,000, 200,000 listeners to show up at your rallies or listen to you on a daily basis, like an Alex Jones or something like that. But the average person has no clue that is even out there because it's not reported in the newspapers. It's not on television where everyone has access to it and can stumble on it. It's not on terrestrial broadcast radio where anyone can accidentally tune into it by scanning their radio dial. And, you know, or there's articles being written about it, or, you know, like the only way to stumble across it on the internet is to specifically go to that website where it is, where it exists, or if someone else links to it. But you still have to go to that website that that person links to. Like the Drudge Report links to InfoWars.com.
You can get the information, and that's a wonderful thing about the Internet. But still, 90%...
But it's really hard.
98% of the people are getting their news the easy way, spoon-fed to them by the networks, and... they're going to control. They're going to control the parameters of the debate. So maybe the only way to do it is real grassroots, is for us to form informal organizations face-to-face across the country.
Yeah. I mean, look at our neighborhoods now are very disjointed. It's all the see something, say something mentality, like in New York City. We're all spies. Everyone is a spy of each other. No one likes to talk to each other. I mean, you really can't, like, approach someone on the street, just, like, be standing next to somebody and just, like, strike up a conversation, because that's just weird. Like, what are you, a molester? Like, what are you going to, like, borrow some money? Are you going to, like, a multi-level marketing scammer or something?
I saw signs like that when I was down driving down, I think it was the New Jersey Turnpike a few days ago. Something, watch carefully, or if you see something, say. So I was like, whoa. I said, wait a second, this is 1984. You know, that's why you come back to the war feeds the national security state. The war issue trumps all. It trumps your Fourth Amendment rights to be protected from unreasonable searches and seizure. It trumps your First Amendment right of free speech. That's why war is poison to a democracy.
Yeah, right.
You know, it also gives license to secrecy. See, it creates the cult of secrecy because, I can't tell you because this is national security. And now you create this whole hierarchy within your society. Your status depends on how many secrets you know, right?
Yeah, I mean, look at how many job applications it says, do you have security clearance?
That's right.
You know, like during all of 2009, I was looking for work. I was working very sparingly. It was impossible to find any work at all. And I filled out countless online applications, and on almost every single one of them, it asked, do you have security clearance?
You're kidding.
Yeah, every single job application.
So what do you say? Yes, what do they know, right?
I can't tell you.
I can't tell you.
I should just feel it. I should have just put yes.
My security clearance is so high, I can't even talk about it.
But I can still fill out yes. Well, this is the stupidest question.
We've come to a pretty pass. So, you know, one I came across an item I think that you would be of interest to you. This is from Minnesota Public Radio. Mm-hmm. You remember Senator Paul Wellstone, the great senator from Minnesota, and he went down in a plane crash.
Yep,
and
sadly.
It was 25th of October, 2002. Well, FBI records have been revealed, which might also raise new questions about the plane crash that killed Senator Wellstone, his wife, his daughter, and three staffers. That's right. Although the National Transportation Safety Board determined the crash was caused by pilot error, FBI documents reveal for the first time that specific criminal leads were pursued by investigators. Now, if you remember, that was a very critical time when he died. Senator Wellstone was one of the most impassioned opponents of the Gulf War back in 1991. Mm-hmm. And before, as Bush was beating the drum to go to war in Iraq, he stood on the fence for a long time. And then he finally got off the fence and he came out and he came out against the attack on Iraq. And he voted just 2 weeks before he died against the resolution for the invasion of Iraq. And he was a very passionate, idealistic person, and he was also a Jewish senator. And that, of course, the Jewish lobby had been pretty much lined up in favor of the war. Mm-hmm. So his opposition to the war was effective on a couple of levels. And when he died, not only was probably the most eloquent voice removed against the war, but it happened to be the tying vote in the Senate. There were 50 Democratic senators, and with his death, there were only 49. So with his death, all of the chairmanship of the committees in the Senate switched from Democrat to Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought when that plane, and it was no, I could see no reason, you know, why the plane, it seemed like just coming in for a landing on a perfectly ordinary day, and it just, boom.
Yeah.
And he's dead. So now we know that the investigators were looking at its possible crime.
Is there anything, any result? Did they find anything?
No, the Minnesota Public Radio just said that the records indicate that they that criminal leads were being pursued.
I hope somebody out there is going to pick that up and run with it.
It's just that assassination
request or something.
Assassination has become such a common feature. Again, we're talking about the Kennedy assassination of 63. Especially since then, it's become such a common feature of politics today.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they're always palmed off as accidents. And one of my perversely, I would say, favorite examples of this. Is the, of course, the Ron Brown death, if you remember. He was Clinton's Secretary of Commerce. And I was sitting and happened to be watching the TV in a lunchroom when it was announced Ron Brown's plane has gone down and he may be dead. And no one knew where the plane had crashed, but the camera went to the Pentagon where they were showing us what was wrong with the plane. Well, they didn't even found the wreckage. How did they know what was wrong with the plane? And then they talked to the president. It was in Yugoslavia. I think it was Croatia. He's interviewed. He says, well, the weather here was just fine. I can't understand why this plane went down. Well, it apparently just flew into the mountain and crashed. And, of course, the next day, the Pentagon, our government, put out that it was one of the worst storms ever had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Just terribly violent weather. And
look, remember what we talked about earlier, how the first report is always the accurate one?
Exactly. And I just happened to be catching it, you know, just as the news was breaking.
And if you're just the average moron, you completely wipe the first report out of your memory.
You got to focus on the earliest report.
Because it's newspeak now.
It's Dan Rather saying, geez, a tower went down just like a control, whatever he said, something.
Yeah,
just like a demolished building.
Yeah.
You know, geez.
48 hours later, well, it had to come down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Ron Brown, of course, he's dead, and it was a plane crash. But months go by, and there's a pathologist, a colonel in the Air Force, who's given speeches on the necessity for doing proper autopsies, and he's out someplace around Pittsburgh, and he says, "Well, here's a really good example." He says, and he shows an X-ray of Ron Brown's head. He says, "Now we look at Secretary Brown. This hole in his head is a perfect 45 bullet hole."
Yeah.
So naturally, there are headlines in the Pittsburgh Times-Picayune or whatever, and Ron Brown had a bullet in his head, right?
Yeah.
This story died so fast.
It was probably there before the crash.
It was, yeah, right.
Pre-existing
condition. That story was never seen in the New York Times. It never made it to network TV. And that colonel was sent, I think, on a permanent paid vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's of course, you have so many others, but... that one just struck me as it's so flagrant, and yet the story never went anywhere.
No, why? I mean, you oh my gosh! You know, if anyone's ever read 1984, you know about Newspeak and Crime Stop, and what's the one? What's the other one? But
well, of course,
I can't remember. But the one where if you hear something that's contrary to what you previously believed, you just wipe it out of your mind.
Is that right?
Which one is that?
Well, the main character's job was to
censor
go back.
The news. Yeah.
Censor. He would go over to the old news. Excuse me. He would go back to the old newspapers and he would change the stories to be consistent with whatever the dictatorship wanted at the moment.
Right.
So there'd be nothing inconsistent.
Yeah, we've always been at war with Eurasia. Now we've never been at war with Eurasia.
Right. Okay.
Well, we've never been at war with Eurasia.
Okay. Tell me what you want me to think.
It's
much more simple that way. Then I don't have to strain my brain. And of course, you had the Emanuel Goldstein. Who was the villain who was probably never existed, but he was the one, like Osama bin Laden.
Well, they never tell you if he did or not.
You never know. You never.
Which is one of the great parts about the book, though,
right?
Because you're left hanging to the
end.
You're
left hanging. Supposedly he was a disloyal person from the inner circle of the dictator, and he was a traitor, and so now he's responsible for all the evil that's done. And then they would have these. At the movies, right? They would have, they would show his image.
The 30 seconds of hate.
30 seconds of hate, and everybody would be yelling and screaming. And I think so much of Osama bin Laden, because all the evidence suggests that he's been dead for about 9 years, that he died in Tora Bora and at the end of 2001. And that was what was reported.
Most people's memories are not that long, though. But if you want to talk about football,
They'll tell you who
won the Super Bowl in 89.
Exactly.
You know,
2001. It was reported in an Egyptian newspaper. Osama bin Laden died of his, I guess, diseases related to his kidney problems. And the source of the report, according to the Egyptian article, was some guy who said, I knew him, yeah, and I watched them put him in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't exactly speculation. And
right.
He was dead. And so for 9 years, we've been probably dealing with a fabrication like Emanuel Goldstein.
But it's convenient and it fits their needs.
Yeah.
You know, they need him to be alive.
That's right.
You know, so. And I think like most psychotic people out there, most psychological criminals or just sadistic people who know how to take advantage of the weaknesses of the mind.
Yes.
And this could just be your business partner or your wife or husband or just some jerk down the street or the cop or anybody. This is just a personality flaw, or who knows, but maybe they don't think it's a flaw. But if you know how to take advantage of somebody's weaknesses, you can easily get what you want. You know, the government knows that they need Osama bin Laden to exist, right?
Right.
And they know that they can get a lot by keeping him artificially alive. It's kind of like someone saying, you know, I know that you think that everything's your fault. So whenever anything bad happens, I'm just going to blame it on you, and you're always going to think that you did it. So
that's
I can
right.
get away with anything. I can steal your wallet and just accuse you for being forgetful, and you'll just think it was your fault. You know, so it's like taking advantage of someone else's personality flaw. So like the government knows that the American people have really short memories, really short attention spans, and that they believe what they're told because they're just generally lazy.
Right.
And they've been programmed to be so over the past 50 years.
Yeah, actually, one of the ironies I find is that you hear this refrain that teachers are trying to encourage critical thinking.
Yeah, right.
And that has not been my experience.
No way, because, I mean, my stepson is in school, and he always will write something for social studies that is a little bit contrary to what the report is supposed to be about.
So
and he'll get marked down for it.
Sure. Is that right? Yeah.
He was marked down for writing a report on the Civil War last year that said that Lincoln didn't necessarily want to free the slaves.
Right.
And that it was just something that happened,
which is true.
Which is true.
He said, if I could save the Union and without freeing the slaves, I'd do so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So he was marked down for that.
Yeah.
And the teacher basically said, well, this isn't what we talked about.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Right. I thought you were trying to teach them to think for themselves.
They're not. That's all BS. As I can say BS.
Yeah. Should I dump you for that?
No.
I don't like abbreviations.
But that's what it is.
Well,
it's eyewash, you know, critical thinking, but they don't want it because critical thinking leads to, geez, why did these buildings fall down at free for all speed? When in the history of the world, no buildings ever collapsed due to a fire. This doesn't make much sense to me. They just want you to, okay. They've come up with an answer. Good enough. Let's move on.
You know, the government always talks about like we have the best and brightest minds, you know, like, but if any of them ever step out of line because of a side effect of being bright, they're knocked right back into
that's
place.
That's right. And that's probably one of the reasons
so it's
why.
It's just a line of.
And maybe one of the reasons
a sales
why
pitch.
We're losing out in the world because what is one of the main qualities that Americans have? It's our individuality.
Mm-hmm.
It's our critical thinking, our ability to our kind of iconoclastic nature, right? And if you beat that out of us and try to turn us into just obedient slaves,
right.
America's not going to work well because that's not what we do.
No, I mean, our system is based on entrepreneurship.
That's
and
right.
If you have a system that favors bigness and buys out any competition to create a single monolith in industry, you know, so
which is the model we have now.
Yeah. Three banks, three car companies and, you know, nothing to compete because if you come up with a better idea, if you come up with an engine that runs on 10% of the amount of fuel, then they'll either just blow up your plant, kill you, buy the patent and sit on it for the rest of your life. You know, like we've had so many technologies that were just squashed in their infancy, fuel
right.
cells and solar technology, wind power years and years and years, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and water engines, hydrogen cells, hyper fuel efficient gas cars, electric cars. You know, there's a great documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car?
Wonderful, yeah. Yeah, you know, and that was a GM car that they made in California, right?
And it's like some individual comes up with this technology, they just buy it, put it in a vault, and it's like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You remember when they
That's
bring
right.
back the Ark and they put it into this like Pentagon,
that,
vault,
right?
You know, and it's like, and then the camera pulls back, and it's just like an endless aisle of secrets, and they're all just in these generic boxes
for
with numbers.
For people who don't know that story, maybe you could tell the story of the electric car and how that.
I can't actually recite too much.
Well, that was the GM was required to make it, as I recall, by the California state government.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they were supposed to be getting off gasoline, right?
Accidentally did a good job.
Okay, and accidentally did a good job. They made a really good electric car. And people were allowed to lease it. They couldn't buy it, but they could only lease it. But a lot of celebrities got into it, and they loved their electric cars, right? And then GM said, there's not much money in this. And they bought the Hummer company. And they said, wow, there's a lot of money in Hummers, which got, you know, whatever it is, 8 miles to a gallon.
Yeah, then they elected a governor who drives one.
It was a disaster in terms of America's energy program. But they said, we got to get rid of this electric car if people like it. So they did these ads, and they show them in the film, Who Killed the Electric Car? I can get it. Your library, watch it. The ads for the electric car were so ominous. They were intentionally downers, so that after you watched this ad, you didn't want one, right? They really sabotaged their own product. But that wasn't enough. They decided they had to take them all out of circulation.
Yeah.
So the people who were leasing them had to surrender them. They come and get your car. Oh, no, I love this car. No, they took the car. And then the people who had leased them said, well, what are you going to do with the cars? And groups of them would go around and say, where are the cars? Let's, you know, they were following the cars, and they were held at these lots, and people said, my God, what are they going to do with our cars? And in the dead of night, GM took the cars to a junkyard and had them shredded.
Uh-huh.
There is not one car left, according to the film, that is intact. They had them shredded to nothing. And I think there's one in a museum, but it's only the body.
And really, what is there to gain by that? I mean, seriously, what can you gain by shredding a good idea?
A short-term profit. And that's what the country, that's the ethos that runs America.
And it's like, you know, and that's not perfect, because there's a lot of people who are like, well, you know, we have to cut our electricity consumption in this country because our power grids are overloaded, and plugging in our cars overnight certainly isn't going to do us any good. But, you know, there's a lot of alternatives to that. Like, how come like 10 years ago we didn't make it a normal thing to start building all new homes during the housing boom?
Right.
Because God knows we were building enough houses.
Right.
Why couldn't we have integrated solar panels into the roofs or something like that?
Right.
So that, you know, it becomes 15% of every house's production is from these built-in integrated solar panels, you know, like, and you could get whatever tax rebates or anything to build in this power consumption.
That would be so rational.
Production.
It doesn't happen. I think it doesn't happen because our government is run by a brokerage operation in which the powerful corporate interests go to the table, and the healthcare, energy policy, whatever it is, they sit down at the table with Obama or whoever, or Bush, and they decide what policy should be. And that policy is going to be the one that's in their interest, not in the interest of the nation or the people. And we're stuck with it.
I mean, like, I live in an apartment house with it's got four apartments in it. All right. And that's got like a humongous roof line. You know, if that house has integrated solar panels, like, you know, my power bill to CL&P is like $90 a month, and there's only three of us in this tiny little apartment. It makes no sense, like $90 a month just for like two bedrooms in this little apartment. And you know, if every building has like built-in solar panels, like,
it seems like it's the way to go.
We would be paying like $30 a month,
and that's where
the
investment should be. I just
but people don't want that because CLMP wants their $90 a month for every apartment.
Oh, sure. It's tough to break that. The government has made some grants to solar panel manufacturers, but I noticed this article on them from the November 3rd New York Times, that a new solar panel maker that had won $500 million in federal aid to build a state-of-the-art factory plans to shut down a plant and lay off workers.
Yeah, why not?
And the reason is that they face intense price competition from Chinese manufacturers.
And you never want to look back in time and be like, well, we should have done this, we should have done that. We should just have like good ideas going forward. But really, we should be the leader in that.
We should. This is an industry.
We have so much potential, but there was no price incentive to go into solar panels 10 years ago or 15 years ago, because it just wasn't feasible. Like, it was too expensive. And usually something is expensive at the beginning, but it's a good idea.
Exactly.
It becomes cheaper as more people buy it, and it becomes more feasible to mass produce.
And sometimes you need a push from the government. You got an important, a critical industry like that, you got to make sure it gets off the ground.
Yeah. But why would you want to actually lower prices for people? Like, you know, we are just like, you know, fish to be harvested. You see those fisher boats, those tuna boats, and they just like drop in these nets and they just like haul up all these like tons of tuna. Right. Like that's the American people to the giants of industry. They're just like, we'll just cast our nets and
somehow
haul another load of suckers.
Somehow we've got to break this. And I think, as you and I have discussed on other shows, that banking is a critical element of this. That I think that the private banking cartel, which controls our money system, is a critical, as maybe the most critical element in the whole concentration of corporate power, which has taken over our government. And if we could start with that, changing the money system and ending the war, which it feeds off of, that we would make it, which also diverts our resources from our real economy, that would be the two things to do to get us, the guard to start to get us back on the right road.
Right. Yeah.
Go check and see if very good. Yeah, I think we're coming to the end of our show, and Casey should be on in a couple minutes. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're streaming live at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with Gus Cantavaro. And the name of our program is In Context. To correspond with us, please visit our In Context website blog, which is incontextreport.com.